the end of the Ebola outbreak again today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The World Health Organization says the Ebola outbreak in West Africa is over after Liberia is declared Ebola-free for a third time. Liberians just hope they can finally stop living in fear.
We were engulfed by fear. Fear of each other, fear of our own way of life.
But a big mystery remains unsolved.
40 years since the first Ebola outbreak, and we still don't know where the virus lurks between human outbreaks.
Also, you don't have to spend a lot to offset your carbon emissions, and that might be a problem.
For $1 or $2 to make much of a difference in a project is pretty unlikely.
How carbon offsets actually work. That's ahead today on The World. We've got the latest on those attacks in the Indonesian capital today. A tragedy for sure, but reports from Jakarta sound a little less menacing than the bombings may suggest. More on that later here on The World. But let's start with another story that now seems less menacing than it did 2 years ago. That's when an Ebola outbreak started in West Africa. According to the Centers for Disease Control, the virus killed more than 11,000 people and infected more than 28,000. Today, the World Health Organization declared the outbreak to be over. Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea had been where almost all the cases occurred, and now they're all officially free of Ebola. Throughout the epidemic, we checked in with Liberia's Minister of Information, Lewis Brown. Today, he says Liberians are celebrating, but with caution.
People are slowly returning to our way of life. And in fact, we're still recovering from the after effects. We were engulfed by fear. Fear of each other, fear of our own way of life, fear of our innate culture of values and beliefs. It affected our economy. It affected the way mothers would care for their children. It went to the heart of who we are. We were able, with the help of partners, to find our way out of this, and we've been able to overcome it.
That fear, of course, led to vigilance. There were songs about Ebola prevention. People got used to washing their hands in bleach, to not shaking hands, to just being really hyper-cautious. What are the lingering effects of all those things today in Monrovia?
We're back, actually, to gradually shaking hands again. But yes, you're right. In fact, in many public places in the Ministry of Information where I work, a public facility, we still have a bucket, our water, our soap, and we're still encouraging people to watch. But it has altered the way we treat patients at medical facility. That will remain in place for a very long time. We have now a triage system is being institutionalized. Our people are being trained and retrained. And thanks to many of these preventive infection measures at our medical facilities, just to step back a bit, we saw many of our hospitals and clinics literally became incubating places for the virus because of poor infection prevention procedures that we had in our medical facilities. Now that we've had this tragic experience, these things have improved. And so, yes, there's a lot of hard feelings. There's a lot of sad memories. We've lost a number of loved ones. I lost a former classmate who graduated from high school together. He rose to become a medical doctor at the John F. Kennedy, our biggest referral hospital. He lost his life fighting this virus himself. But what has come out of it is the capacity that has been built to be able to save more lives going forward.
Mr. Minister, for you personally, I'm just curious to know, when you travel overseas, are you treated differently now than before the Ebola outbreak?
There were moments where we felt unfairly stigmatized, that we did not invite this upon ourselves. It was a disease, but we understand people were afraid. People have to prevent themselves as well. So it became difficult to distinguish between the disease and the person. And sometimes you felt treated as a disease as opposed to being a person. But we were able to overcome all of that. We're now pleased that we're being again respected as we've always been around the world.
Lewis Brown is Liberia's Minister of Information. Even as the WHO marked the end of Ebola today, it warned that new flare-ups of the disease were possible. So is it over or not? David Quammen is the author of Ebola, The Natural and Human History of a Deadly Virus, a short volume he researched and wrote when the outbreak began in 2014. Quammen says Ebola is still out there. We just don't know where.
This is a virus that is so harmful in humans, so virulent in humans, that it can't reside merely in humans. We would know about it if it were lurking in humans somewhere else in the world. It has to live somewhere because a virus can only persist, can only keep itself alive within the cells of some other living creature. So it's got to be in a critter out there. It's got to be in some other sort of organism in between the times when it is killing humans.
And why does it have to be in another kind of species out there, a critter, as you say? I mean, why couldn't it just be defeated?
You hear about the eradication of polio. You hear about the eradication of smallpox. The reason those viruses can be eradicated is because they are not viruses that jump between humans and other species. The fancy term for that is zoonotic pathogens, zoonotic viruses. A zoonotic virus is one that passes back and forth between a non-human organism and humans. And anything that falls into that category is something that can't be eradicated from the world simply by curing all humans, because it continues to exist in its what they call reservoir host. That's the other organism.
Yes. So what about these reservoir hosts? I mean, these are animals. Is it strictly mammals or all animals that could carry around Ebola but don't get sick from it?
It's not strictly mammals. It might be some other kind of an animal. It might potentially even be a plant or a fungus, although mammals are the first suspects. And you hear people say, well, Ebola, it lives in bats. That is suspected, but that has never been proven. The question of Ebola's reservoir host is still unsolved, and it's a very important question because until we solve it, we should expect another outbreak to occur eventually.
So you traveled into the jungles of Central Africa to the sorts of places where Ebola lurks in these reservoir hosts. What does this part of the world look like, and what is the thinking about what kind of animals, what kind of species do carry Ebola?
Well, of course, in Central Africa and to a lesser degree in West Africa, there's a lot of forest. There's a lot of richly diverse tropical forest, and there are people living in that forest. There are small villages and towns within the forest. And that typically is where a new Ebola outbreak begins. It doesn't begin in the big cities. It begins in the villages. It begins in the provinces. It begins close to the forest. Why is that? Well, presumably because somebody comes into contact with the reservoir host, whether it's a bat or a rodent or an insect or a tick, we don't know. But somebody comes into contact with that creature and becomes the first human case. And from that point, it spreads human to human. 40 years since the first Ebola outbreak, and we still don't know where the virus lurks between human outbreaks.
David, what do you think are the key lessons from this outbreak in West Africa that might prevent another outbreak, or at least could inform us about what could trigger another outbreak?
Well, the tricky thing to remember is that this was a horrible outbreak that became an epidemic in West Africa. More than 28,000 people were infected. More than 11,000 died. Of those 28,000 cases, all but one of those were cases of human-to-human transmission. The very first case was a case of reservoir host, ? Transmission. So it might seem like the question of reservoir host is relatively unimportant. You know, 28,000 cases of human-to-human transmission, one case of reservoir host-to-human transmission. But until we identify the reservoir host and find ways to prevent future spillovers, to keep people away from that creature, whatever it is, that bat or that rodent or that insect, until we solve that mystery, we can't prevent future outbreaks, and the next one might also lead to 11,000 human deaths.
David Quammen, the author of Ebola, The Natural and Human History of a Deadly Virus. Thanks very much.
Good to talk with you, Marco.
It is the crazy tale that keeps getting crazier. I'm talking about the story of Mexican drug king El Chapo Guzman and his arrest. So here's the latest. A Mexican newspaper called Milenio got access to a series of text messages that were exchanged between El Chapo and actress Kate Del Castillo. You might remember that Kate Del Castillo and actor Sean Penn actually went to El Chapo's hideout to interview him. That was in October of last year. Then a few months later, last Friday, in fact, El Chapo was captured. Now, the text messages between Del Castillo, the actress, and El Chapo, the drug king, I gotta say, are very revealing. Jo Tuckman is here to tell us more about them. She's Latin America bureau chief for Vice. So last Friday, Joe, when the news came down, the narrative was kind of that Sean Penn had used Kate Del Castillo as the intermediary to get to El Chapo for this interview. But if you read these messages and we're to believe they're authentic, then it starts to look like Sean Penn was kind of the pawn in El Chapo's attempts to seduce Kate Del Castillo. What's going on here?
I think it's more that Sean Penn is not a particular concern of El Chapo's. That's what we see in the messages. I mean, his main concern is to meet up with Kate. She wants to bring along Sean Penn, and he says, yeah, whatever, you know, whatever she wants. He's very concerned with meeting up with her. She also seems in the messages to be very keen on meeting up with him as well. And I think what comes out of it in terms of Sean Penn is rather more that he's kind of incidental, which is revealing, both very, very revealing of El Chapo, that he really doesn't know who he is.
So what kind of things are El Chapo and Ms. Del Castillo talking about in these messages?
Well, they're partly talking about, obviously, some project, which we're assuming is the project to film something, to make a movie about his life. They're talking about, they're quite personal. The messages get more personal and more flirtatious as time goes on. The first message that's printed, which has actually been confirmed as authentic by the Mexican authorities, the first messages printed are from September the 25th. That's a week before Kate Castillo and Sean Penn go to meet Chapo. And basically they're kind of arranging that meeting a week later. So there's a lot of that kind of logistical talk. There's a lot of talk between Chapo and his lawyer, who's also on the message thread, about the kind of phone that they're going to buy Kate Del Castillo for her to communicate directly with Chapo. Mm. I mean, in some ways, I mean, in terms of the actual investigation, they're not particularly revealing. I mean, on one level, all they tell us is that El Chapo has a weakness for women, which is something that we have known for a long, long time. He's got something like 15 children. That's not a surprise. But this kind of interplay between celebrity and the narco world is fascinating, and it's a very revealing conversation in terms of that.
So apparently in El Chapo's hideout, he had Kate Del Castillo DVDs. From what you've read of these texts, was this fondness for Del Castillo a love thing, or was it more fatherly affection for this woman who happens to play a drug baroness on TV?
It's not clear. He obviously had a thing about her, you know, but it's not direct. At one point towards the end of the conversations, he says he wants her to meet his mum, you know, that he wants to introduce her to his mother, and that he's told his mother all about her. I mean, it's definitely suggestive, it's definitely flirtatious, but quite what it is in more concrete terms, we're not sure. I mean, in the Rolling Stone interview, the long Rolling Stone interview account of the encounter written by Sean Penn, he talks about Chapo greeting Kate Del Castillo. I think the quote is something like a daughter returning from college. Mm. And Penn also describes how Chapo walks Kate Del Castillo to her cabana, to her cabin where she's going to spend the night, and comes straight back.
Did Kate Del Castillo ever get that pink BlackBerry from El Chapo, that gift he promised her?
I think it didn't come in pink. I think that was the problem.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, that is a problem.
I couldn't swear on this, but I think it didn't come in pink. He was upset about that, and I think they decided on gray, but I wouldn't swear on that one.
Jo Tuckman, Latin American Bureau Chief for Vice, thank you very much for this.
Thank you.
Coming up, how carbon offsets really work here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're tuned to The World. Planes, trains, automobiles, kind of ironic when you think about how at least 30,000 people from around the world got to last month's UN's COP21 climate summit in Paris. That's a lot of carbon emissions for a meeting supposedly about cutting our carbon footprint. Actually, the UN set up a website for attendees to offset the impact of their travel. So how'd that work out? We're going to get the answer from two people who were there, our own environment team, editor Peter Thompson and producer Carolyn Beeler.
So Carolyn and I both flew to Paris from the East Coast of the U.S., and our flights produced roughly a ton and a half of carbon dioxide between us. We knew we wanted to offset that, and UN conference organizers figured a lot of other people at the COP21 summit would want to, too.
Because it would be ironic if you organize a COP and the only thing you achieve is increasing the global footprint.
That's the UN's Nicholas Svenningsen.
So we are trying to encourage everybody to do three things: to measure, reduce, and offset what they cannot reduce.
Carbon offsets are basically a way to make up for your greenhouse pollution by either removing or preventing the same amount elsewhere. So you pay to have some trees planted or to help support a green energy project or something. That's what the UN's new effort is meant to help people do.
And that is a campaign we call Climate Neutral Now.
The Climate Neutral Now campaign has a website, and they had a booth at the conference site. But when I found it, the process of actually buying the offsets ended up being way more complicated than I had time for. So I took a pass for the moment. And when Carolyn went out later to ask around, she found that I wasn't alone.
Can you tell me, did you buy the official UN Paris Summit offsets for your travel here?
I'm afraid I did not.
I did not?
No.
No, I didn't really know much about it.
I have, via the UN's Carbon Neutral Initiative.
Okay, Carolyn here. As you can tell from my unscientific survey, it seems not many people were using the UN's new system. And we found that's actually pretty typical of the bigger picture. In 2014, way less than 1% of global carbon emissions were mitigated with voluntary offsets.
As for why, it's safe to say most people don't know about offsets. Others who do know might not want to pay what's basically a voluntary tax. And even for people who do want to pay, there's not a lot of confidence in the system, as Carolyn learned from this guy.
Part of the problem, in the past at least, has been it's very hard to know which carbon offsets really represent real reductions or not.
That's Dan Bodansky. He flew to Paris from Arizona, where he teaches international environmental law at Arizona State University. Someone like him should be able to figure this stuff out, but it's complex, even for him.
I have tried to do some research to try to figure out which ones make sense to buy, but it's actually been difficult to get good information on that.
So it's sort of like it's a lot of work to figure out if your money's actually doing anything?
Exactly.
The problem is that there are a zillion different offset programs, and it's hard to know whether an offset is really doing what's promised. And if it is, whether what you're paying for is really a new reduction, or if the company is getting paid more than once for the same thing.
If you think about it, if you can't tell the difference between a good offset and a bad offset, you're almost encouraging people to figure out how to sell bad offsets into the market.
That's Mark Trexler, who's with the consulting group The Climatographers. Trexler helped develop the very first carbon offset program in the 80s, but he's not such a fan anymore. He says the low prices of many of today's offsets, maybe a couple of bucks per ton of CO2, are troubling.
For $1 or $2 to make much of a difference in a project is pretty unlikely. So the fact that the offset market is at this sort of $1, $2, $3 level really has to raise a lot of suspicions about whether you're making something new happen with that money.
Now, the UN says its offsets are thoroughly vetted, so they can be trusted. Still, the people I spoke to at the conference turned out to be a pretty representative sample. The UN's final numbers show that way fewer than 10% of people who went to the conference bought offsets on the website.
But that doesn't include people like us, who were a little late to the game. I finally paid for ours just this week. But even back here at my desk, it was a frustrating process. I had to choose a specific project out of almost 30. And when I did, it turned out that the project's PayPal account wasn't set up, so my purchase got canceled. Eventually, I just chose the first one on the list, one in Chile that turns greenhouse gas emissions from pig farms into biogas. In the end, offsetting the CO2 from our flights to Paris cost $4.80, a lot of time and effort for very little money, which did make me wonder about their effectiveness despite the UN's assurances, and maybe tells us part of the reason that so few people at the conference seem to have used the system.
To be fair, I think a lot of people did make their travel more sustainable. They just did it in different ways. Some people I talked to took the train to Paris instead of flying. Others, like Costa Rican Felipe de Leon, bought offsets from programs they'd worked with before, and so they really trusted.
I have absolutely no doubt where my money went, and I like that.
But perfect or not, De Leon likes the idea of offsets in general because they get people thinking about climate change as a result of their day-to-day activities.
You wouldn't even consider chucking a bag of chips outside your window anymore in your car, and maybe your parents or their parents probably did it a million times. I think that sort of attitude has to become ingrained for climate change as well.
All of which raises a much bigger question, whether countries should put some kind of price or tax on all carbon emissions to basically make all of us take responsibility for our climate pollution. But that idea is still super controversial in most places, so for now, it's mostly off the table. For the time being, though, if you're thinking of offsetting some of your carbon footprint, you can check out the UN's new website at climateneutralnow.org. For The World, I'm Peter Thompson.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Another bit of environment news for you, this one from Alaska. This month, an estimated 8,000 black and white seabirds called murres were found dead on a beach there. Their bodies washed ashore in the town of Whittier on Prince William Sound. Wildlife ecologist Dan Greer says this is the biggest murre die-off in Alaska this season, but not the first one.
Murre carcasses started to be noticed this fall in Alaska. And as the winters progressed into December and early January, observers and fish and wildlife staff have started to find thousands of dead murres on specific beaches.
Greer works for the USGS National Wildlife Health Center in Madison, Wisconsin.
I think we've examined close to 100 of these that they've shipped down. The consistent finding is that these murres are emaciated. They have very poor body condition.
Alaskan scientists have also observed live seabirds changing their flight patterns.
They started to see murres show up farther inland on lakes and rivers, which suggests that the murres are having trouble finding appropriate food at sea.
Murres may be starving because of abnormally warm surface temperatures in the North Pacific this past year. The seabirds eat by diving into the water to catch fish, and they have to consume the equivalent of 10 to 30% of their body weight every day. Scientists think the abnormally warm waters are either killing off the murres' prey or pushing the birds into cooler waters.
They could be too deep. They could be moving to areas in the ocean where the murres aren't used to finding them, or are in a spatial mismatch of where the murres normally forage. And these are all now are just hypotheses that the science folks up in Alaska are trying to figure out how to test.
As scientists figure out what's happening, they are also worried about what the 2016 El Niño warming effect on the Pacific might mean for the murres and their aquatic prey. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, Indonesians react to the terror attack in Jakarta today.
There was a hashtag on Twitter basically saying, "We will not be afraid."
Plus, the late Alan Rickman on his own distinctive voice.
If my voice teachers from drama school were here now, they would tell you that it was the biggest problem I had.
It's all coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Let's check in with Jakarta and get the latest on that terrible news from earlier today. Several places in the Indonesian capital were attacked with bombs and grenades. Suspicion, Indonesian authorities say, has landed on an Indonesian man who went to Syria to join ISIS. More on the whole scene of extremism in Indonesia in a moment. First, though, let's talk with Sandra Siagian. She's an Australian who works for the UN in Jakarta.
I was in the office. I'm on the 7th floor. Just before 11 a.m., my colleagues and I, we heard what sounded like a loud bang. My colleague actually thought it was thunder, but I said, no, this doesn't sound like thunder. So we walked over to the window and we looked outside the window and we could see smoke coming up from what looked like the parking lot of a building, kind of two doors down from our building. We saw smoke coming up, and then when we looked to the left out to the main road, we could kind of see more smoke coming up. And later on we heard that was a bomb blast that had gone out near the Starbucks across the road from our office. And following that, everyone was in a bit of a panic in the office, but everyone remained calm. And then we're sitting down, and then we heard after that another bomb go off. And we just kept hearing them until we counted about 7 blasts altogether. What we thought sounded like explosions. I'm not sure if they were all explosions. It could have been gunfire as well. And so we were just told to sit in the office and stay there.
So, I mean, weren't you and your colleagues, Sandra, just compelled to run out of the office?
Yeah, initially, like, everyone kind of wanted to do that. And everyone grabbed, you know, everyone's like, grab your wallet, grab your phone, let's go. But then we were told by security to stay in our office, and we were told it was safer to obviously stay within the office, and our office just went into lockdown. So we were all just told to, like, move away from the windows, and everyone kind of just held it around the center of the of our office.
This must all be pretty unsettling for you.
Yeah, it was actually, like, obviously because no one ever realizes, no one ever thinks this will actually happen, or, well, like, you've seen it on the news, but you never know when this kind of thing will happen. So everyone was kind of, like, panicked. Like, I felt like I was panicking and... but everyone was just kind of trying to calm everyone down, like just comforting each other. And we'll just, all we could do was just sit and wait. So.
How are you doing now, Sandra?
I'm fine now. Like early this morning, I was obviously shaken up and I felt, I was panicking at first and I felt shaky. And I was feeling really scared, but my colleagues helped comfort me. And I think just knowing that there was other people in the office together, it was fine. I'm now at home, and I'm feeling fine. Like I managed to make it home, and obviously the streets aren't as crowded as it usually would be on like a Thursday afternoon during peak hour traffic. So it was easier. It was more comforting to know actually that I could just get home quickly. Like I feel safe now that I'm at home.
I mean, we found some incredible emotions and reactions here in Boston during the marathon bombing a few years ago. Terrifying situation. Did it make you think about life and fate and what you want to do with your life?
It did a little bit, especially considering I'm living in Jakarta and most of all my family's back in Sydney, Australia. And so my first reaction was, do I call them? Do I call my friends? How do I tell everyone? Or I'm not even sure what's going on because, you know, at that point I wasn't even sure, like, do I waste my battery on my phone or do I get on my email, like, even to just check what's going on news sites online. But, yeah, that was a thought, thinking, like, do I get – like, that was a point where I was like, do I get in contact with people? Because we don't know what's going to happen next. We don't know, is something else going to happen or what? So, yeah, it definitely was a moment where I thought, is this the time where I make, like, the phone calls home? So, but I was able to, like, message everyone and let them know that I was safe. And luckily they were able to have, like, watch the news back home and they could kind of see what was going on, like, as it was happening too.
When are you and your UN colleagues expected back at work, Sandra?
Well, I think we continue working, but we'll probably be back probably next week. Like we're still working, but I think tomorrow most of us will be working from home, but we'll probably go back in next Monday.
Sandra Siagian, thanks so much for speaking with us.
No, that's okay. Thanks for having me.
Sandra Siagian is a UN worker who witnessed the terror attacks in Jakarta this morning. Indonesia is the world's most populous Muslim country, but as I heard earlier today from Patrick Wynn, Asia correspondent for our partners at Global Post, Islamic extremism is not very strong there.
If you look at polls, Indonesians, when polled, overwhelmingly reject ISIS and their worldview. However, you do have a small percentage of people who are inspired by ISIS. A lot of them are pretty harmless. They're fanboys or wannabes and people that are excited by ISIS's online propaganda. But every now and then you have people that are motivated to actually take action. And I think that's what we saw in Jakarta today.
Any kind of homegrown terrorist or extremist networks that don't have connections to ISIS or Al-Qaeda?
There are homegrown jihadis in Indonesia, and what they envision is a hyper-conservative, Saudi-style, Islamic law and order type of state. I don't want to say that Indonesia is not a conservative place, but that is really out of sync with the mainstream view. I mean, this is a country where you can buy beer, guys and girls can go on dates. It's not such a hardline place. So their vision for the country is pretty warped.
How loud, how vocal has been kind of the rejection of these attacks today from Indonesians?
It's pretty overwhelming. There was a hashtag on Twitter, which is used by a lot of Indonesians, basically saying, we will not be afraid. Indonesia takes its terrorism problem very seriously. The Bali bombings in 2002, that was the most vicious terrorist attack in the country's history. And they really started cracking heads after that. You do not want to be identified as a jihadi by the Indonesian government. They can be very nasty. They will go into your village. They will interrogate everyone you've ever talked to. They will make your life miserable. So they take counterterrorism very, very, very seriously.
This may be a tough question to answer, but what do smart people say accounts for Indonesia's relative moderation on this front? I mean, aren't there any memories of colonialism, you know, the Dutch Empire, any desire among Indonesian extremists to address past history?
Sure. There was certainly guerrilla-style movements against the Indonesian government itself, which was seen as colonialist by some parts of the archipelago. We shouldn't conflate that with the global jihadi movement that we're seeing today.
Sure.
We have to remember that Indonesia is a place that does not look to the Middle East and see, oh, they're my brothers. I mean, they may all be Muslims, but the style of rule and even the style of dress and the way that women are treated in the Middle East, that does not feel familiar at all to most Indonesians.
Patrick Nguyen with our partners at Global Post, speaking with me from Bangkok. Thank you very much, Patrick.
Thanks, Marco.
This year, we at The World, along with our team from the World in Words podcast, are planning to bring you several stories on efforts to keep languages alive, or in some cases, bringing them back from the dead. Languages from all over, Africa, Europe, Asia, and here in the U.S. Along the way, we'll be asking some hard and potentially awkward questions. What's the value of these languages to the people who speak them and to the rest of us? Could the effort in saving them be put to better use, fighting for other rights or creating prosperity? And what's the role in all this for linguists and non-native speaking outsiders? For our first story in this periodic series, we're sticking close to home. It's about a lesser-known Algonquin language and the people who used to speak it and may one day speak it again. The Shinnecock people of Long Island, New York. Here's Alina Simone.
Walk into the Wunichanuk preschool on a typical weekday morning, and you'll be greeted by the smell of burning sage and words unheard anywhere else in the world. Children singing in the Shinnecock language. Yes, this is the only Shinnecock reservation, and it's a small one of around 650 people. But the reason the sound of Shinnecock being spoken is so unusual is that there are no fluent speakers of Shinnecock left, haven't been for more than a century. With New York City only an hour and a half drive west, the pressure to assimilate has always been intense for the Native Americans of Long Island.
It didn't seem like a reasonable thing to spend their time and effort on for their children if it wasn't going to be helpful for their future.
This is Tina Tarrant, the tribe's language researcher.
People don't imagine that your language is going to disappear entirely. That's like such a strange concept that people don't think of it.
But a few years ago, Tina came up with an even stranger concept, bringing that vanished language back.
Well, I just always wondered why people weren't saying more things in our language. We always talked about culture. We always made things and did the songs and the dances. And we didn't use our own words to describe what it was we were doing. So I started looking for the words.
As a child, she collected those words like baseball cards.
Common phrases, nicknames from what my grandmother was called by her grandparents, and you know, little bits and pieces.
So when she had her own child, it made sense to give her a Shinnecock name.
Tohonish. She's named after a hawk who flew by my cousin's house, my mother's house, and my house the morning that she was born.
That was in the 1980s. Hardly anyone on the reservation had a Shinnecock name back then. Tohonish is now 31.
My generation is the first generation in probably three generations to have Algonquin names. It was something that my mom made sure that all six children had names in Shinnecock.
Tina's decision was personal, but it was also strategic.
The reason for putting these unusual names in the local community was so that our words would continue to be spoken and they would have a firm understanding of at least one or two words in our language, even if it were their own names.
It worked. Soon, other tribe members were asking questions about Shinnecock words, wanting to give their children native names too. Tina saw hope for a larger revival of the language and organized some workshops on the reservation. But the challenges were intense. Aside from a handful of surviving word lists, there was only one written source for the Shinnecock language, a Bible translated by a native man, Kokono de Long Island, in the mid-1600s. Tina had no institutional support, no money, not even a college degree. It took years of effort to track the Bible down, on microfiche from a library in Scotland, of all places. The tribe itself was too busy fighting a protracted battle for federal recognition to make language revival a priority. You'd think being surrounded by the uber-wealthy would give the Shinnecock an advantage over other tribes. Not the case.
Now, for the New York elite, summertime generally means one thing, and that is decamping to the Hamptons, the holiday spot for the rich and famous in America.
Towering hedges stretch down Southampton streets for miles, obscuring the multi-million-dollar homes of celebrities like Rachel Ray and Howard Stern. But unless you count lending their name to one of the world's most exclusive golf clubs, the Shinnecock don't share in that wealth. In a place where the average house sells for almost $2 million, the average Shinnecock family makes barely $14,000 a year. And Tahanish says that's not the only drawback to being an urban East Coast tribe.
There are a lot of issues relating to sales of the land or leases that were never made good on. So we lost a lot of territory. And that has always been a challenge for us because here we are, a small Native American community in the middle of the home of millionaires. So here we have to take these millionaires to court over our land. It's kind of really an uphill battle for us.
But in 2010, Tina's scholarly goals dovetailed with the tribe's judicial ones when the Shinnecock became the 565th tribe to be recognized by the federal government. 2 years later, the tribe voted to build a new preschool, and a radical concept was floated to incorporate Shinnecock language into the curriculum. The school opened its doors this past summer with Tahanish as its manager. It was up to a team of 7 people, Tahanish, her mother, and 5 teachers, to figure out how to bring Shinnecock back to life.
Hakameya is welcome. But then somebody else said it the other day to me, and I was like, huh? Hakameya?
Everybody was kind of in their beginning stages of learning of a language. And we started with simple words that can be used in the classroom. We started with translating popular songs such as Twinkle Twinkle Little Star.
Up above, okay, so high, like a bird in the sky.
Tahanish has since left her job at the school, but the language program continues. Clearly, there's a long way to go before kids are watching Dora the Explorer or thumbing through apps in Shinnecock. But people are starting to use native words around the reservation, beyond just, hey, Tahanish. Simple things like
Muskanawash and Waninakon and, Wanimotapan. They're all words for, like, good morning, good evening. It's very interesting how it's like people are owning it. They're owning their identity by just seeing these words on a regular basis and starting to use them with each other.
It's a big change from when Tina first launched her effort to reintroduce Shinnecock back in the 80s.
The hardest thing is to feel like you don't know your own culture.
Looking back at all the challenges to breathing life into the Shinnecock language, this hurdle, the psychological barrier, may have been the biggest one.
This is all a part of our identity, and it's not something that we all grew up with. So to put that bad feeling aside, that this is not something that I know, it's something that you can learn. It's okay that we weren't taught this growing up. This is something that we're bringing back, and we need to embrace.
Owning your identity, even in the Hamptons, you can't put a price on that. For The World, this is Alina Simone from Southampton, New York.
For more on languages, small and large, check out our podcast, The World in Words. You can subscribe at iTunes or go to pri.org/language. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. When Al Jazeera America launched in 2013, a lot of media critics said it was a game changer for this country. But now we hear that the media company based in Qatar is pulling the plug on its American channel. Azmat Khan was a reporter with Al Jazeera America, and now she's over at BuzzFeed News. You were one of those journalists who thought Al Jazeera America was the future, Azmat. What is your reaction to this news a year after your departure from Al Jazeera America?
For so many of us, it hasn't been surprising. Though we had very high expectations when joining, it became clear quite early into the channel and its network in America, it was almost doomed to an extent. People like to argue that it's because AJAM was too foreign, too serious, or too toxic a work environment. But more than anything else, I think it was digital naivete.
So that's why it was doomed? Just didn't kind of have a digital strategy?
It was looking at old models for journalism rather than innovating or experimenting with new ones. if you look at exactly what they invested in, $500 million to buy a cable channel that was already struggling, and then invested an additional $2 billion more to operate this. And every time their ratings were low, the then CEO would say, look, CNN and MSNBC launched to low ratings. It'll take us a little while as well. And he was essentially referencing a decades-old model that didn't exist in this incredibly different and changed media landscape. Al Jazeera America invested in this channel at the expense of innovating or trying to do something new or pursuing this idea that the future of journalism is digital. And it was a stunning miscalculation.
So you're saying it should not have had any kind of television output, just a straight digital platform?
Exactly. Imagine what AJAM could have been if Al Jazeera had spent that $2.5 billion on an experimental digital media enterprise and not a cable news channel. If you look at what they did digitally, you'll see actually some very strong reporting. They weren't getting an audience on air, but they definitely were online. If they had pursued and put their efforts there and then worked to innovate, it would be a totally different story.
What do you point to, Asmat, when you're asked about the good journalism that that money bought at Al Jazeera America?
More than anything, I think Al Jazeera had the best coverage of Native American issues in the United States. Exactly. So, you know, you can find a great piece on Native veterans who were the highest serving minority group in the military. The idea was Al Jazeera America would bring Al Jazeera's mission to give voice to the voiceless in the United States. And this was one underreported territory that they really carved out well. They also looked at poverty in great depth. You know, I remember working on a story about America's first openly gay imam, and this was Al Jazeera. So in many ways, they did things that people didn't expect, and they did them well.
And when people ask you, where am I now going to find quality foreign news coverage or quality Native American news coverage on TV, on cable, where do you tell them to go?
On TV, on cable? That's a great question. No one asks me that. When people ask me for recommendations about consuming international coverage, they're largely asking me about the internet. For example, on Roku, if people did want to stream television, they could easily stream a digital network that is foreign. But most of the time, what people are doing is finding international stories online. Even as foreign bureaus for newspapers close, you're starting to see digital organizations investing in that. So there's no dearth of this online. The question is, are those old school traditional ways of covering the world going to last?
Asmat Khan, ex-Al Jazeera America, now over at BuzzFeed News. Thanks very much for this.
Happy to chat, Marco.
And finally today,
I can teach you how to bewitch the mind and ensnare the senses. I can tell you how to bottle fame, brew glory, and even put a stopper in death.
No mistaking that voice. Alan Rickman, of course, playing Professor Snape from the Harry Potter series. Rickman died today of cancer and took that voice, his many voices, with him. So let's just take a couple of minutes to remember that voice. A sensuous, shadowy purr, wrote the New York Times in their obit. The Guardian called it a bass rumble, which could sound like a creak or a groan or a beckoningly sensual purr. All right, purr seems to encapsulate his voice vibe. From wizards to sad robots to the Sheriff of Nottingham to a has-been Shakespearean actor.
How did I come to this?
Not again.
I played Richard III.
Five curtain calls.
There were five curtain calls. I was an actor once. Damn it, now look at me. Look at me! I can't go out there and I won't say that stupid line one more time. I can't. I won't.
That great sci-fi spoof, Galaxy Quest, Rickman played washed-up British thespian Alexander Dane, who has the role of the Spock-like character Dr. Lazarus in the fictional TV series. His voice was iconic, but not everyone was so fond of it. Here's Rickman with Charlie Rose in a 2012 interview.
If my voice teachers from drama school were here now, they would tell you that it was the biggest problem I had in training, and that they were trying to... One teacher said, you have a voice that sounds as if it's coming out of the back end of a drainpipe.
It has been mocked.
Hello. You've reached Alan Rickman at 555-0122. Please leave a message at the beep. Hello. Alan Rickman, it's Alan Rickman. reminding you to move the pork chops from the freezer to the refrigerator. Do not disappoint me.
The cartoon Family Guy there.
Benedict Cumberbatch, I heard you do an impression of Alan Rickman.
Jimmy Fallon challenged Cumberbatch to a Rickman off on his late night show.
We'll do some classic lines from some R&B or hip hop songs.
God. All right.
As Alan Rickman. I have them written down.
God. Okay, all right. Oh, God, okay. Rolling down the street, smoking in dough, sipping on gin and juice. Laid back.
Rickman as Snoop Dogg. Rickman always seemed to take the mockery on the chin. He even got Fallon to apologize to him via helium balloon.
He had what is described as a Rickman off.
It's a famous game people play.
So, so I just want to know what you have to say about that. Breathe it in.
I'm very sorry you were offended. I'm very, very sorry.
Apology accepted.
Yeah.
Today, it's equal parts comedy and tragedy. Rickman's voice is something that we will never forget, truly. Alan Rickman died today after a battle with cancer. He was 69.
Jay, sun ain't gonna shine anymore. The moon ain't gonna rise in the skies. The tears are always clouding your eyes. When you're with us.
We put together a list of some of our favorite Alan Rickman roles. You can find that at PRI.org. And that is all from us today, truly, madly, deeply. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.